Let's start. Are you ready, Dr. Sinclair?
I'm fine, yeah.
Yeah, so if you are okay.
You want to share my screen? If you do the introduction, then I'll share this.
Yeah, I introduce you and a little bit, and I do some explanations, and after that you can start, right?
Okay.
Okay, so good evening to all of you. My name is Victor López. I am the director of the Chair of Sport and Physical Education and Center of Olympic Studies at the University of Girona. welcome to this webinar titled Sport, a Reflection of Society. So before introducing our keynote speaker, I would like to inform you about a couple of things. The first one is, as you know, the presentation is in English. So the presentation will run around 45 minutes, more or less. And after that, we have time to discuss with our keynote speaker, around 40, 45 minutes too. This time of discussion could be in English, French, Castellano, or Catalan, as you prefer, because our keynote speaker, he doesn't have any problem with that. So the second point is we are recording the presentation, and you can follow also the presentation in YouTube channel of the Chair of Sports and Physical Education. So having said that, let me introduce our keynote speaker, Dr. Graham Sinclair. For me, it's an absolute pleasure to introduce you. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Sinclair. He's a teacher in EUCES, with a center associated to University of Girona. He's a teacher in basically in history of sport and sociology of sport, and he's expert in these fields. So he obtained his degree in modern European history in the University of Warwick. His master in popular culture in the Open University, and his PhD in cultural studies in the University of Girona. Because of we met for a long time, so thanks, Graham. It's my absolute pleasure to share this time with you. I'm so happy that you accept our invitation, and I'm so sure that we enjoy your presentation. So now it's your time, so you can start whenever you want. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, I'll share my screen in a moment, but first of all, I want to say thank you to my colleagues at the Center for Olympic Studies. So thank you, Marti, Pera, and thank you, of course, to Victor as well for organizing this event this evening. As Victor says, we've known each other for a long time. And it's very nice. It's very nice for us to be seeing each other in this environment as well. So I'd like to say thank you, especially to the three of you. And obviously thank you to everybody who's chosen to participate this evening. As Victor said, I'll be doing the presentation in English. If at any moment, because of nerves or whatever reason, I start going too quickly, or if I start becoming too Scottish, I apologize in advance and please tell me and we'll try and rectify that situation as quickly as possible. When I was asked to do this presentation, the word which was used was webinar, and webinar is a sufficiently new word for me not to understand what it means, which is perfect. I'm convinced that what I don't want to do this evening is to give a lecture, and what I hope that happens this evening is that we can develop some kind of conversation and perhaps some kind of debate related to sport and society. I don't have time this evening, and I haven't chosen to go into detailed definitions of what sport means or of what society means, but perhaps these are things which we can discuss later on this evening. And as Victor said as well, can I please reiterate, please feel very comfortable to ask your questions or make your contributions in the language that you feel most comfortable with. And we'll do our absolute best to understand them and to react to them in an appropriate way. So with your permission, I'll share my screen now and I'll start my presentation. Mm. sorry, I'm in the wrong place. Right, okay. So as I said, thank you once again for inviting me to make this presentation. When I was first invited to make this presentation, my first idea was in fact to have a discussion about whether or not politics and sport should mix. And I thought to myself, that's probably a very boring subject. And it's also probably a very old fashioned subject and a debate which has in fact been put to bed. And that we all know that politics and sport have always mixed, do mix in the current climate, and will probably always mix. But just to be on the safe side, I decided to have a quick check on Google, as we all do, and I discovered these headlines. I'll give you a moment to have a look at them. These headlines come from a variety of sources, from a variety of newspapers, and it seems fairly clear that I was completely wrong, and that for a lot of people, it's absolutely clear that sport and politics either don't mix or shouldn't mix, or if people attempt to mix sport and politics, they should be punished. The person who caught my eye most of all was Donald Trump. And I was surprised that Donald Trump, of all people, should be saying that sport and politics shouldn't mix. And I was discussing this yesterday evening with my nephew, David, and David said, of course, Donald Trump is the perfect example of somebody who lives a life where sport and politics don't mix. He should be in the White House, but in fact, he's playing golf. So maybe he's actually a living example of the fact that these two things don't mix. But I'm older than my nephew, David, and I remember this, which I'll let you see, which was a wrestling match when Donald Trump participated in the wrestling match, which became known as the Battle of the Billionaires, in which not only did he wrestle with another billionaire, who you can see in the picture, but after throwing him into the floor, he tied his opponent to a chair and shaved his hair off, claiming victory and opening the way for the future, for his future job as president of the United States. So if I'm honest with you, one motivational reason for me doing this presentation, apart from being very happy working with my colleagues, as I said at the start, is to somehow prove that Donald Trump is not only a hypocrite, but that he's wrong. So I want to tell you about my first and my earliest memory of it being clear that politics and sport do or did mix. When I was a kid, I was brought up in Glasgow, and politics and sport were very, very clearly mixed. The rivalry between Celtic and Rangers, in my opinion, is an awful rivalry, which sometimes spills over into sectarian violence. But it could never be said that the rivalry between Celtic and Rangers, the two football teams from Glasgow, had provoked a war. But I remember when I was a kid, when I was about 5 years old, my father telling me about a football match which had in fact provoked a war, and a serious war in which between 2,000 and 3,000 people died between El Salvador and Honduras. This match, or these matches, were qualifiers for the 1970 World Cup in Mexico. It was a two-match qualifier. The first match took place in Honduras, and Honduras beats El Salvador 1-0. The second match, the return match, in El Salvador, and El Salvador beat Honduras 3-0. What did this mean? This meant that we had to go to a deciding match, and the deciding match took place in Mexico City. El Salvador won the match 3-2, and within 2 weeks, the countries were at war. Now, there are two ways we can analyze this match. One way, we can talk about the tactics, we can talk about the goals that were scored, we can talk about the ferocious rivalry that existed between the two sets of fans. But one of the main points I want to make tonight is that I think that we can reach a different understanding of sport, not a better understanding necessarily, but a different understanding of sport and a deeper understanding of sport if we pay very close attention to the context in which sports events take place. And so, when we look at some details of this match, we can talk about the fact that Pipo Rodriguez scored a goal in extra time and managed to hang on to the victory. We can talk about these rivalries that existed between the two countries, both in terms of sports and in terms of politics. But in fact, it's impossible to understand these rivalries if we don't understand that both countries had been in conflict in one way or another for years, specifically over border problems. And these border problems still haven't been resolved. Land border problems and particular maritime border problems in the Gulf of Fonseca. The matches also took place at a time when many farmers from Salvador, who had the tradition of moving to Honduras, which was a larger country but with a less dense population to work, had been expelled. They'd been expelled as a result of agrarian reform, which was the result of popular pressure, which in turn had been a response to the pressure which had been put on peasants by American fruit companies controlling more and more of the land in the area. What happened? Many Salvadorian farmers were evicted from the land that they'd been working on in Honduras and sent back to their own country, where the land which their families had previously farmed was no longer available to them. In my opinion, it's impossible to understand why this football match was so tense, or these football matches were so tense, and why a war broke out, unless we look at a more deeper context. In my opinion, this particular example of football is impossible to understand fully unless we look at the socio-political context in which it took place. The next sports event I want to talk about, and here I think everybody's clear that a socio-political context was fundamentally important, is when we talk about the 1936 Berlin Olympics. When we think about the Berlin Olympics, we tend to think of them as the Nazi Olympics. And the main images we probably keep in our heads are the images of these stadiums which have been decorated as a showpiece for the Nazi government and for Adolf Hitler. And we also probably think of Jesse Owens and his success as an Afro-American athlete. But I want to have a little look at the background to these specific Olympic Games to illustrate that context is important, but also that the message or even the meaning of a sporting event can change. In fact, Germany was awarded the Berlin Olympics before Hitler came to power. Germany was awarded the Olympics in 1931. And the objective, in general terms, of the International Olympic Committee was to bring Germany back into the international fold after the First World War. To some extent, it was an exercise in public relations. What they didn't know was that in 1933, Hitler and the Nazi Party were to come to power. When the Nazis came to power, they themselves weren't convinced that they wanted the Olympics. They didn't really know if it was a good idea or a bad idea, but they decided to use the Olympics as a platform for their ideology, and in particular, as a platform to demonstrate that the Aryan race was a superior race. An international boycott of some kind was organized against these Olympics. An alternative Olympic Games was planned to take place in Spain, but these particular games didn't take place because, in fact, the Spanish Civil War broke out at the same at round about the same time. Because of the protest movements in the United States, the American Olympic Committee decided to send a delegate to Berlin to see if it was true, to see if the descriptions they'd heard about the levels of repression of trade unionists, of Jews, of homosexuals, of all kinds of political dissidents were true or not. And so the American Olympic Committee sent a delegation to Berlin in 1934, to Germany in 1934. And in fact, this delegation decided that in fact the Americans should participate in the games, that the description of Nazi Germany had been exaggerated. I'd like to point out here that the leader of the American delegation was somebody called Avery Brundage, who you can see in this photograph. with a close German friend who was called Karl Ritter, who was not only a member of the International Olympic Committee, but was also a leading member of the Nazi Party. And average Brundage's position was, he said, we shouldn't get involved in politics, but that in fact there was a Jewish communist conspiracy intent on keeping America, North America, he meant the United States, out of the Olympic Games. So the United States participated. Something else which we remember from the Berlin Olympics is Jesse Owens, of course. I can't remember the figures exactly, but I think Jesse Owens won 4 gold medals. I think he broke 4 world records, and I think he broke or equaled 9 Olympic records. Amazing. And of course, Jesse Owens has gone down in history as a hero and somebody who represented a challenge to the ideals of the Nazi regime. And I completely agree with those sentiments. However, it shouldn't be forgotten that when Jesse Owens returned to the United States, he was one of the very few victorious American athletes who did not receive a presidential reception in the White House, quite simply because he was black. And we should think about the fact that at the time, Roosevelt's staff within the White House was still segregated on racial terms. The point I'm trying to make is that on the basis of his results in the Berlin Olympics, Jesse Owens is a hero in terms of an anti-Nazi or an anti-racist hero. But the same person wasn't respected by everybody in the same way when he returned to his own country. We'll be returning to Jesse Owens. The other main point I was trying to make here is that the very meaning of the Berlin Olympics was transformed. As I said, at the beginning, as a ceremony of welcoming Germany back into the international community, and then being transformed into an attempt to make a very positive ceremony celebrating the values of the Nazi of Nazi politics. I want to have a look at something else now, which is this, and it is related. I may take some trying to explain this relation to you. As I mentioned before, from my point of view, the meaning of the Berlin Olympics changed between 1931 and 1933. This picture from Paris Match, which some of you may recognize, is a picture which the French cultural theorist Roland Barthes deconstructed in one of his most famous works called Mythologies in the 1950s. And what Barthes was essentially saying was that there was a difference between what something signified and what something denotated, what it physically represented in this case, a photograph of a young black soldier in the French army, and what that signifier, the photograph in this case, actually meant. What was its connotation? So from Barthes' point of view, we see that in this photograph, which is on one level a photograph of a young French soldier saluting, the deeper meaning of this photograph was in fact that colonial soldiers in the French army shared the same values as the French Republic and was probably looking in an admiring way at the French flag. It's an interpretation, but the main point that Barthes was trying to make was that there's a difference between something on the surface and the meaning that that signifier may in fact have. If we have a look at this picture next door, you'll see the tall black man pointing at the kid. I'm not sure if you recognize that person. You know who the person is, but you may not recognize him. You probably recognize him in this photograph. He's the guy in the middle. It's Tommy Smith. This photograph is a lot better known than that photograph. And this photograph has become a symbol of the fight against racism, of the fight for equality. And for most of us, and I hope for all of us who are participating in this seminar this evening, is an extremely positive image. It's an image which for us is charged with positive values. It's also an image which is charged with lots of symbols. And lots has been written about the symbols in this picture. One of my favorite essays is an essay which discusses why Tommy Smith is wearing his glove on his right hand and John Carlos is wearing his glove on his left hand. Lots has been written about this. One particular article suggests it's because of their different political background. But in an article which I read, John Carlos explains it in a far more simple way by explaining that one of them had forgotten their gloves and that they only had one pair of gloves for the two people. However, the wearing of the black gloves and the clenched fist is a black power salute. There are other symbols which are important. If you look at John Carlos, you'll see he's wearing some beads. He's also wearing a black t-shirt, and the black t-shirt is to cover up USA on his running vest underneath. The beads which he's wearing are to symbolize the ropes which were used in the southern states of the United States to hang Afro-Americans in illegal lynchings. You'll notice also that Tommy Smith is not wearing shoes. He's not wearing shoes in solidarity with poor farmers and in particular poor Afro-Americans. The other thing which we can see, which all three men are wearing, are these white badges. And these white badges are in fact badges for the Olympic Committee or the Olympic Organization for Human Rights. The Australian athlete, Norman, was sent home immediately just for wearing this badge, a badge in favor of human rights. That's all. We have to remember when this took place. This took place in 1968 in Mexico. 1968 was the height of the civil rights movement in the United States, but was also the year in which Martin Luther King had been assassinated. 1968 was a year where student protests in France had linked with strikes in some of the major French factories and ended up with a general strike of 10 million workers in France. In Mexico, Mexico City, just weeks before this protest, hundreds of students, we still don't know exactly how many students, were murdered in the Plaza de las Tres Culturas in Mexico City because they were protesting against their government. This is the backdrop against which this extremely brave protest took place. But as I say, things are not constant. For us, this is a very positive image. The headline in Time magazine, when this took place, transformed the Olympic slogan of higher, faster, stronger to the ugliest, the angriest, and ugliest, angriest, and I can't remember the third one, but there was a nasty reworking of the Olympic slogan. The LA Times said that Smith and Carlos were in fact making Nazi salutes. Things change. Interestingly, when Smith and Carlos returned to the United States, they did eventually manage to carve themselves out careers in sports, and in particularly in American football. They managed to find themselves reintegrated somehow, in my opinion, because of the strength of the civil rights movement in the United States. Such a civil rights movement didn't exist in Australia. And Peter Norman, when he went back to Australia, had a time which meant he should have qualified for the 200 meters in 1972, but wasn't selected. When Sydney was host to the Olympics, he wasn't invited. And this finally, this statue to him, along with an apology from the Australian government, the statue was only erected after he died in 2018. It's a sad story, but at the same time as that, it's an inspiring story from my point of view. So what we've seen up until now are examples in which sporting arenas in one way or another have been used for political reasons, either positively, negatively, but somehow to express political ideas. But the title of the presentation tonight was, in fact, to what extent is sport a reflection of society? As Victor said at the beginning, I teach sports history, and one element of the course which I teach is about sport and physical activity in prehistory. I'll talk about this briefly, but in some ways, I feel that the difference between sport and physical activity in Paleolithic society and Neolithic society give us clues to the way in which there is a relationship to the type of physical activity and sport we do happen and the type of society which takes place, the type of society which exists. As I said at the start, I don't want to get into a deep discussion now, but maybe we can have it later about definitions of sport. But if, and in some definitions this is the case, competition is a necessary part of a sport, then sport did not exist, as far as we know, in Paleolithic society. We have absolutely no evidence of competition existing in Paleolithic society. In Neolithic society, yes. In Paleolithic society, no. In Paleolithic society, we have archaeological evidence and other types of evidence nowadays as well, which suggests that people were involved in activities such as swimming, such as running, hunting, jumping, dancing, a variety of activities, which may have been to a lesser or greater extent linked to survival or the preparation for survival or just having a good time. But we have no evidence that competition existed in that period. This cave painting here comes from Egypt in the Sahara Desert near the border with Libya, and is around 10,000 years old. So somewhere between the Paleolithic, late Paleolithic, early Neolithic period. Later on in Neolithic societies, we do have examples of people involved in competitions. We have examples of spectator sport, and we have examples of people being offered prizes for sports activities separate to other activities within society. What I'm suggesting here is that in a society with no competition, there's absolutely no reason why there should have been any competition in these activities, which look like activities we would describe as sport nowadays. In a society, a Neolithic society, when competition had begun to develop because of the production of a surplus within society, and because of the beginnings of a social stratification of society into social classes, it's absolutely normal, and it shouldn't be a surprise to expect that sports activities reflected that society and that competition began to exist. We can come back to this later in the discussion. It's a very brief overview that I've given you there. What I want to talk about a little bit now, and I'm jumping ahead in time, is to talk a little bit about the first Olympic Games. Because I think the first Olympic Games are a very clear example of sports events or events related to sports, which were very much related to the type of society and very much a reflection of the type of society in which they took place. In the very first Olympic Games, or the first recorded Olympic Games, in 776, before the Common Era, the ceremony and the event lasted for around 5 days. But there was only one sports event, and the sports event was a 200-meter sprint. So if we take a 200-meter sprint, even if we include the qualifying events, and we put it within the context of 5 days, we know that lots of other things were happening, and lots of other things were happening. The Olympic Games were, in fact, a ceremony to the god Zeus, who was the head god in the Greek pantheon. And the Olympic Games were a place where a celebration of Greek religion and Greek culture and Greek values. The participants in the sports, even in later stages, were representatives of the different city-states which made up the Greek Empire. And so each city-state would choose their representative, one representative, to compete in the one event. And the qualifications, they depended to some extent on how good that athlete was, but also the only people who could participate were, first of all, men, only free-born men, only men who'd completed their military service. Those were the people who could participate. women couldn't participate, slaves couldn't participate, foreigners couldn't participate. And interestingly, if we look at the Athenian model of democracy, which has been argued and could be argued was the most advanced democracy which existed in the world at the time, the criteria for participating in that democracy were more or less identical to the criteria used in order to say if somebody could participate in the games. The Athenian democracy, which is probably the most advanced democracy compared to all of the other Greek the Greek city-states, and was a democracy for rich men with two Athenian parents who were freeborn and who had completed their military service. Women were excluded, slaves couldn't participate, foreigners couldn't participate. This isn't a criticism, this is a description of what the situation was at that particular time. Something else which is very important is that for the Greeks, sport was not a separate activity. When you went to school in ancient Greece, which once again was the domain of these men, you studied sport, you studied philosophy, you studied politics, you studied history, you studied rhetoric. All of these different things had a similar value. The idea of physical activity being a lesser activity or a separate activity from intellectual activity and intellectual endeavor was completely unknown to the ancient Greeks. This is something which, in my opinion, was invented later and something which I'll be talking about a little bit later on. So the Olympic Games, a festival of Greek culture, of Greek ideas, of Greek ideology. And a lot has been written about this, something which I've spoken to some of my colleagues about, which I often criticize, is that when we pick up many books which are called the history of sport, more than 50% of those books concerns the Olympic Games. There's a lot less happening. There's a lot more happening out there, but unfortunately, those things don't necessarily get studied because of the importance that we've been given to, the importance that has been given to those Olympic Games over the years. There's something else which is interesting, which I don't feel gets the attention it deserves, which are the Herian Games. No, the Herian Games were games in the same way that the Olympic Games were a celebration to the god Zeus. The Herian Games were a celebration to the goddess Hera, who is the wife of Zeus. And if you look at a map of ancient Olympia, you'll see this: the temple of Hera is right in the middle of the Olympic, let's call it the Olympic city, next to the Temple of Zeus. There's a very interesting article by Dolores Miron from the University of Granada, where she explains that from her perspective, the Herian Games represent the different stages of female life in ancient Greek society. There were basically two words which described, I'm using the word female, which were used to describe females in ancient Greece. The two main words, they were virgins and women. We also have Amazons. That's a different story, and I don't have time to look at Amazons today, but basically, young women who were described as virgins, which in the Greek context meant unmarried, were in fact regarded as animals. And they were regarded as animals who needed to be tamed. And the way you tamed these animals was by marrying them. And the respectable place for a rich Greek woman was to be a part of a Greek man's domestic property. In any case, we know that the Herian Games took place, and we know that they involved running events for young Greek women. We don't know much about them. Most of the contemporary, or in fact, the only main contemporary source we have is by Pausanias, who is a second century geographer who wrote about them. But my feeling is that some kind of process of gatekeeping has happened over the years. Gatekeeping, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is an expression which gets used a lot in social psychology, but it gets used a lot in cultural studies as well. And in cultural studies, gatekeeping is the idea that somebody, consciously or not, decides what is and isn't worth studying. Or, for example, what is or isn't worth including in the news or including in a newspaper. As an anecdote, I'll tell you a very quick story. A few weeks ago, just after Esther Guerrero had won, I think, the 800 meters and the 1500 meters in an international competition, about a week later, I switched on TV3 to watch the sports news, thinking, maybe I'll see something about her on these news. Nothing. This was a week later, not immediately at the time. And I realized not only was there nothing about that particular athlete, there was no women's sport at all on the TV3 news coverage. TV3, for people who are not listening from Catalonia, is the National Catalan Television Channel. So I wrote a letter of complaint. I did. I was going to say I wrote a question. I wrote a letter of complaint. And I said, what the hell are you playing at? I said, I don't believe that on that particular weekend, no sport involving women had taken place in the whole of Catalonia. And I received a reply from a woman who said, thank you for your interesting email. Great. And they said, we do pay very serious attention to women's sports. Unfortunately, there were some more important events taking place that weekend, such as the Formula One race in I can't remember where, and I can't remember what the other one was. The most important thing for me here is the fact that the representative of TV3 had said more important events. Who makes that decision? Similarly, with the Heraean Games, very little has been written about it, in my opinion, not just because one of the only sources we have is Pausanias, is because people have not chosen to write about the Heraean Games because they're women's games and not men's games. Once again, this is something we can discuss later. And I'm getting a little bit tired, so I've decided that we should have a little talk about gangster rap. I don't know how familiar you are with body count. The guy in the middle of this picture is Ice-T, who's most famous for his song Cop Killer. He's a gangster rapper. But Ice-T also created a group called Body Count. And Body Count are a heavy metal, a hardcore metal group. The shortest song on their first album is called No Sport. Unfortunately, the sound quality here will be bad. Don't worry about it. I'll give you a written version of the song. I think it takes 15 seconds or less. Here we go. Yeah, can you hear it or not? No, don't worry. It's very, very short. There's a problem with my sound here. Don't worry. That's the song. This weekend, 17 youths killed in gang war, killed in gang homicides, no sports. No. Why do I think this is interesting? And why, for God's sake, do I think this is relevant to what we're talking about this evening? I think it's interesting for two reasons. One reason is that this is a parody of a news program. And in this program, sports has been separated from serious news. That's one thing. The other thing is that here, what Ice-T is suggesting is that people pay less attention to serious news than they do to sports, and that somehow sports isn't serious or aren't serious, and that somehow sports are used somehow to divert us from more serious things. And that's something I'd like to talk about here, because I think attitudes towards sport are very important. As I said earlier, sometimes sports and sports events, in all forms of sports, as I said, I'm not getting into definitions now, are constructed as separate from intellectual endeavor. That hasn't always been historically the case, and isn't always historically the case now. But as I said earlier, from the point of view of the ancient Greeks, this was an impossibility. This is something we could argue, something which was developed from a Cartesian point of view, with the idea of the mind and body being separate and some kind of duality existing between the mind and the body. That's something we can talk about later. My feeling is that sport can be taken seriously if we take it as a serious subject and we study it using serious tools. What does that mean? That means that if we go back to the football war that I mentioned at the start, yeah, we can talk about how many goals were scored. We can talk about how many penalties there were. Fine if you want to talk about the football match in that way. But to reach a deeper understanding, we have to take other tools to that sport and to that what is in fact a sociocultural event. And it's my position that sporting events and sport in general have a kind of relative autonomy, to borrow an expression, a relative autonomy within society. Sport does reflect society, but rather, it's not a direct reflection. It's probably more of a refraction. So we can see some elements of society, whatever society is, refracted or reflected in sports and sports events. But it's not one-way traffic. My feeling is also that sports events and sports in general also reflect back onto society. I'll give you an example here, which is quite interesting. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the concept of sport washing. Sport washing is the idea, in a way, it's what the Nazis tried to do in 1936. Sport washing nowadays is the idea that you try to organize high prestige events like a World Cup or a boxing tournament or a golf tournament in your country, generally speaking, a country which has image problems. And by having an international sports competition, you normalize that country. It could be argued that the same thing happens with the Eurovision Song Contest, but let's not talk about that tonight. In this photograph, you can see the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia poning with the British boxer Anthony Joshua. At the moment, Saudi Arabia are trying to attract huge sports names in order to give a positive image of Saudi Arabia as a normal country. I don't know what a normal country is. I come from Scotland. But in any case, they're trying to polish the image of their country. Interestingly enough, we've got, you can see Tiger Woods on the right, who in fact refused to take part in those competitions, in the golf competitions organized. Rory McIlroy as well, the Irish golfer, also refused to take part in some certain competitions which have been organized here. So once again, it's not one-way traffic. We have this attempt at sports washing. We have this attempt to normalize a country in a way through sports activities. But in fact, sportsmen and women's athletes have the power to react against it. And my feeling is, and I may be wrong, that more of you have heard about Tiger Woods refusing to play in Saudi Arabia than you have about Anthony Joshua's boxing match in the country. I hope that's true. We're getting towards the end. I've been trying to suggest that sports events in themselves mean very little, and that in fact they have a flexible meaning. So we saw, in terms of the Berlin Olympics, we saw the Berlin Olympics at the start being the idea of welcoming Germany back into the international community, but then being used as a celebration of Nazism. I've included this nice picture of the lake in Banyoles here because I was particularly impressed at the last series of meetings I attended in Banyoles, when the ex-mayor of Banyoles, Joan Solana, gave a very, very nice presentation. And one of the things that he spoke about in terms of ecology was the fact that the Olympic presence in Banyoles in 1992 had in fact had a very positive impact in terms of the ecology, and in particular the ecology surrounding the lake in Banyoles. The reason I'm saying this is that sometimes, in a kind of knee-jerk reaction, people are very critical about the impact of sports events, and especially big sports events. I used to live in Rio de Janeiro, and I went back to Rio de Janeiro after the World Cup and the Olympics, and my sensation was, yes, that it had been a disaster. The state of Rio de Janeiro had gone bankrupt. All of my friends who were either teachers or civil servants in any way whatsoever hadn't been paid for months. And my friend Bira, who's a taxi driver, took me for a tour of all the empty hotels which existed in one part of Rio de Janeiro. So there were tens of empty hotels, but the number of homeless people had increased because they'd been evicted from the favelas in which they'd lived. And of course, they weren't allowed to live in those hotels. That, in my opinion, is a very negative footprint. However, the example we have from Banyoles is a very positive footprint. The reason I mention such extreme opposites is because I think it's not the event in itself or the sport in itself which is important. It's how that sport is managed. And similarly with images. I think just as we looked at Mexico in 1968, for us, the image of Tommy Smith and John Carlos doing the Black Pearl salute is now a very positive image. At the time, it was a shocking image. For some people, it was positive. But as I say, the Los Angeles Times accused them of being Nazis or making a Nazi salute, excuse me. This is a recent image, which I find very impressive. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. This is from a women's football team in A Coruña, I think. And the women are standing because a homage to Diego Maradona had been organized. One of the players, called Paola de la Pena, I think, or de la Pena, chose not to participate. Well, she did more than not participate. She didn't want to participate in a homage to Maradona because she didn't feel it was appropriate, given the fact, from her point of view, that Maradona was an abuser, and to use her words, a paedophile and a rapist. So what did she do? She did in fact participate, but she chose to turn around and sit down during the homage to Maradona. Why do I think that's important? I think that's important on a personal level, because I think it's an incredibly brave statement. But it's also important to suggest that something like the world of football, that it provides an arena just not for the sport itself, but also for some kind of social commentary. And basically, I'm going to finish now, but just before I finish, two little things. I've had these pictures right the way through, which I'm sure you're familiar with, of Naomi Osaka, the tennis player. And it's interesting where we've come to in terms of what sporting arenas are. Tennis, for many, is the land of the privileged. But it's very interesting that you have this young woman of a mixed ethnic background, who's one of the best tennis players in the world, who chooses to use that arena to wear masks. And each day she wore a different mask with the name of somebody who'd been the victim of police brutality. So although tennis and the US Open, I know I couldn't afford a ticket to go there, is in a way the realm of the elite, it's very interesting that it can, despite the fact that it's the realm of the elite, it's also an arena for protest. And finally, one tiny thing. This is a beautiful sign that I saw when I was last on holiday in France, where it says, drive very slowly because kids are playing. And it makes me optimistic, because this is a sign which would never have existed when I was a kid. One, because they don't speak French in Scotland, but in particular, because the person playing football is a girl. So, let's come back to that. So thank you for listening. I'll hand you back to, I'm not sure if I'm handing you back to Victor or to Marti, and please feel free to ask questions in any language you choose, or make any comments that you'd like to. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Graeme. So now it's time for Pera or Marti. You can organize the discussion time. Thank you very much, Graeme. Nice presentation, as usual.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sinclair, for your amazing presentation. Sorry for my English. We will move on to the question time. And I think it will be better if I speak Spanish. It's not a problem. Es el momento de el momento de hacer las preguntas. Si alguien tiene alguna pregunta, alguna cuestión que le quieran dirigir al doctor Sinclair.
Añadir que si quieren hablar pueden utilizar la herramienta de raise hand or levantar la mano y podemos abrir los micrófonos.
Mientras se animan, rompo un poco el hielo. Si le parece una pregunta que quizás esté un poco descontextualizada de lo que hemos hablado, de lo que ha hablado el doctor Sinclair a lo largo de esta hora, pero me gustaría saber su opinión acerca de la inclusión del breakdance en el programa de los Juegos Olímpicos del 2024 en París. No sé si puede guardar relación con la intención de captar a los body count para el deporte.
I'd be very interested to know if there are people who know far more about this subject than I do, in particular about breakdance. I'll make a note of it. I can come back to it if you want, Pedro, but if anybody else would like to intervene, please do that. I certainly don't want the situation to be where it becomes purely a question and answer session with me, you know? I'm absolutely not the font of all knowledge here, and it'd be nice if people could be involved in some kind of discussion. My personal point of view of breakdance is, you know, if you can have people sitting on top of horses in the Olympics, why not breakdance?
Martín, no sé si...
Brian, we have a question through YouTube. I have put it on the chat. Kilian Folguera asked, what about the fact that even with all that protests in a sport, there is still a lot of racism, corruption?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, shall I come back on this now? I mean, what I think is interesting, something which I've seen recently, is that I think that rather than the organizers of events, but at the same time as that, if we look at the organizers of big sports events, things are changing. If you look at the proportion of men and women in the Spanish Olympic team, for example, the proportion of men and women in the Spanish Olympic team, and at least the objectives, in my opinion, are far more progressive than in any company that I know of, any major company that I know of in Spain at the moment, and in any political party. So I think that interesting things are happening even within the big structures of sport. At the same time as that, I get the impression that since the Me Too movement, and especially in the United States with people beginning to take the knee, that sports players, who generally speaking don't come from the same background as the people who organize the sports for them, are beginning to take things into their own hands. I'll give you one beautiful example from football in England at the weekend. There's a tradition in the Premiership, a new tradition in the Premiership, that before each game, the players take the knee as a protest against racism. This weekend, there was a football match at Millwall, which has a history of racism amongst its supporters, and the club has done a great job in trying to eradicate that racism from its stands. When the players at the beginning of the game took the knee, Millwall, one section, a minority section of the Millwall fans booed. They challenged it. When a goal was scored in the match, one of the players ran in front of that group of supporters and took the knee again. That's impressive in my opinion. So I agree with the question that, yeah, lots of protests are happening. I agree that there is corruption, there is racism. But from my personal point of view, the more that the participants in these sports at all levels take control of that aspect of the game, the more likelihood we have of eradicating things like racism and corruption. There's also an interesting point which relates back to the question I asked at the beginning, or the question I said I was asking myself at the beginning, and when I was talking about Donald Trump, about whether or not politics and sport should mix. I saw a very nice interview from the Johan Cruyff Foundation, I think, and I can't remember the name of the person who's speaking, but he says, we must emphasize that sport is part of society and that sport and politics do mix. Because if we don't insist on the fact that politics does mix with sport, then we leave sport to people who have their own political agenda. So I think, yeah, of course, there are still problems, but I think I personally feel quite inspired by what's happening, especially with the taking the knee, especially with the taking the knee movement, at least in the sports which I watch. Yeah.
Here we have another question from Gina Stephens. Would you say sport is an advancement of possible changes in society, or does it follow society's tendencies? I think that this thing is really important.
Well, she asked the question to all of us, huh? Shall I come back? Shall I come
back?
I think from my point of view, and from the point of view of the type of background in social sciences where I come from, the best way for me to understand this is through the concept of relative autonomy. The concept of relative autonomy suggests that cultural practices, and I include sport as a cultural practice, is to some extent a reflection of that society, but that those cultural practices have a relative autonomy somewhere, and that somewhere is in the ideological superstructure. Now, that can mean practices, that can mean ideas, and that can mean places. It can mean a lot of things. But what it means is that the answer to that question is, it depends, in my opinion. So for example, if we see something like Naomi Osaka with her face masks, that for me suggests that sport is capable of somehow advancing changes in society, but only if we accept the idea that sport and politics necessarily do mix. At the same time as that, there are lots of examples of when sport has been used as an ideological tool by very repressive societies, and we can't deny that either. So it's not a conclusive answer, because I don't think good answers are off. I don't think good answers to this type of questions are simple answers, but I think it really depends. But what I think is that sport, like any other sociocultural practice, it depends how we approach it and what we do with it.
I have another question related in the educational field. How you can teach sports in this kind of way to learn para entender que eso, que el deporte es más que jugar, que ganar. ¿Cómo debes enfocar eso desde el mundo de la educación? Porque, claro, vemos eso. A mí me ha gustado mucho lo que has dicho de que ¿quién decide qué es lo que es importante? Y creo que aquí tenemos un problema, porque nos hemos focalizado demasiado en ser mejores, en ganar, y eso es lo que sale en las noticias, es lo que sale en los medios. Y mi pregunta es, ¿cómo se podría enfocar, cómo se podría preparar eso desde la educación para que los estudiantes fueran más críticos?
What I know, Marty, is that I know we have Victor here, I'm sure is far more capable than me of answering that question. And there are two or three other colleagues who are floating somewhere in cyberspace who I'm sure have got something very far more interesting than I've got to say about it. But it's a very important question, I think.
Nothing to say. For the moment. No, it's a really big question, so it's really difficult. So the first main topic is why competition is a bad issue. That's the main question. Or is not competition itself, or is maybe, which is the importance that we put over the competition. And so it depends on the levels that we want to discuss about the sport, and which is the educational potential that the sport has. Probably a sport is not educational itself. Sport is a sport. And we can decide if this tool we can use as an educational device or not. So it's a big question, and it's not easy to discuss in a short period of time. And Graham, just so when you explain the anecdote about the news on TV3, etc., and you sent okay, so I think we discussed about that a long time ago, but I'm not sure. So my point of view is maybe the problem in this particular case is not. Is not related to the women or men, because now you can watch on news on TV3 a lot of news related to women's soccer.
Yeah.
Basically, my point of view is maybe it's not related to women or men. It's related to power or no power, and economical power or no power. So. Just because TV3 has some type of commercial relation with Football Club Barcelona, so but TV3 can't pay the tax of men team, so they decided to put attention on women team. It's not related. To men or women is related to football or not football, to Formula One or not Formula One. Maybe this is a new window to discuss.
Yeah, it's an interesting window for discussion. I mean, I remember when the debate in tennis was happening, as always, about whether or not women and men should be paid the same in the Grand Slams. I can't remember the male player who said, yeah, but we play five sets, you know, we play five sets rather than three sets. And he said, and therefore we generate more money than you do. This guy was like number 30 in the world. And Sharapova replied, who do you honestly think generates more money, me or you? So basically, I think economics move things, yeah? At the same time as that, I think there's a tendency that probably needs to be changed in terms of who has access to what sports at what levels and where priorities lie. Yeah. As you say, it's a huge subject, and maybe next time.
I know that.
Graham, we have another question here from Raquel. She said the Olympics values are interpreted according to the historical moment, or is it maintained? Is it the sense? With what objective?
I'm not sure. The Olympic values?
Sorry. Are the Olympic values maintained in time, or they are interpreted according to the historical moment?
If we talk about values, I think it's virtually impossible to understand what a value was if we're talking about something 1,000 years ago. I think it's very, very difficult to understand it. And I personally imagine, is that the values of the Olympics, even if we use the same language, can't possibly have the same meaning in different historical periods. So that's the only way I can answer that question. For example, I teach one part of my course about the ancient Olympics, and people talk about the fact that amateurism was a great thing in the Olympics. Now, do we think amateurism is a positive thing or a negative thing? I could argue that in the early modern Olympics, amateurism was a way of excluding the working class. So I think it's a very, very subjective thing, but as a general feeling, I just think it's impossible that the values attached to the ancient Olympics are similar to the values we attach to modern Olympics, quite simply because the ancient Olympics were part of a religious ceremony dedicated to the Greek gods, and that isn't the case nowadays. However, in terms of higher, faster, stronger, maybe.
If you can see the chat, we have another question from YouTube related with the media again. Kilian says, how many time do you think women's sports will take to be as important as men's sports by the media and the society? That's difficult.
It's difficult. It's a very serious question. And I think to some extent we have a self-fulfilling prophecy here, in the sense that if it is just about money, and I don't think it's just about money, then we need to do something. And I think we generate interest in things, in many things, by making those things visible. So from my point of view, I would say that visibility, if we're talking about the media, visibility creates interest. And if we have no visibility, then we have no interest because we don't know these things exist. So I guess as long as it takes for athletes themselves to put pressure on the organizations which have editorial control over what we do and don't see, I imagine.
We have another question from YouTube, from Adriana. There's a lot of discrimination between men and women in popular competitions, such as running. For instance, women gain lower prizes, amount of money, than men. More than a question is a reflection. This topic is really interesting nowadays.
Oh, it's really interesting. Punto. Not just nowadays.
It's of interest, I would say.
It's of great interest, yeah. And it's an absolutely, it's a fundamentally important reflection.
And maybe looking, for example, at the images you put in your presentation, maybe it's, in, for example, 50 years in the future, we will see these kind of questions with no sense. I hope that.
If it's impossible to separate sport from society in general, because I think it's impossible to separate anything from society in general, because very, very complex relationships exist between sociocultural practices and the society in which they take place. I think we're living in very interesting times, in the sense that since the Me Too campaign and since taking a knee has become popular in sports events in particular, protest in one way or another seems to be back on the agenda, and protest in one way or another seems to be working. So from my point of view, at the moment, the idea that sport and politics shouldn't mix, as we saw in the newspaper headlines at the start, that's a difficult argument. It's an increasingly difficult argument to win at the moment. And that, I think, is a very positive thing, because it's only by embracing that mixture that we can, in my opinion, make progress in terms of equality in sports.
Does anyone has another question or reflection, any doubt? Graham, a mí me gustaría recuperar lo que has dicho, la idea del significado del deporte, que por sí mismo no es nada. Y realmente estoy de acuerdo con esa afirmación, que si le quitamos todo el contexto, pierde su interés, su significado.
Well, I mean, This feels a little bit like a concluding remark I'm going to make, but it's not a concluding remark, I hope. Victor said something interesting earlier. He said that, you know, sport. And to some extent it is. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with enjoying sport because you enjoy sport. That's fine, you know. There was, when I was younger, a very nasty tradition, in my opinion, in the social sciences, which was either very critical of anything which wasn't politics, or tried to read politics into everything. So if you are running 100 meters, you're actually symbolically fighting against the system, which just may not be the case, you know? It just may not be the case. And it's extremely patronizing for us as social scientists to say, no, he didn't just score a goal, he was actually fighting against capitalist attitude, I think. However, what I think is very important is what is, to follow on you're saying, Marty, is that what sport is, if we look at it, sport as sport, it's a bit like cutting open a human body. We can cut open a human brain and we can analyze that brain. But by doing so, we'll never find an idea. Or from a religious perspective, we can cut open a human body, but we'll never find a soul. With sport, we can analyze the number of goals which are scored, how many passes were made, etc., etc., etc. And that's fine. That's completely valid. And it's interesting. My position is that we can add another dimension if we start looking at it in terms of what its social meaning actually is. It's adding a dimension. It's adding a dimension more than anything else, which is why I said at the start, it means we reach a different meaning. And from my point of view, we reach a deeper meaning because, as I say, my perspective, we'll be looking at sport as a sociocultural practice.
Are there any questions, Martí? Si no hay más preguntas, vamos a cerrar la conferencia, darle las gracias una vez más al doctor Sinclair por esta agradable hora de compartir y darnos conocimientos. Y vamos a dar la palabra al doctor Víctor López para que cierre la conferencia.
No, just to say thank you very much, Dr. Sinclair. Great pleasure to meet this time with you. And thank you to all the attendants. We hope that you enjoyed this time. My wish is not the last one, it's the first one, a sequence of the possibilities to collaborate with Dr. Sinclair. So we hope it. Thank you very much. And gracias a todos. Y esperamos que nos podamos ver en la próxima. Fins a la propera a tothom. I molt bona nit a tothom.
Okay, thank you very much.